The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to be talking about manufacturing poor people. How did we get so many poor people? And was this always the case? I've just finished principal photography yesterday of a major feature film entitled Poverty, Inc. It'll be released in about 4 or 5 months. It goes into post-production now. These are the new poor. These are people who you never would have imagined, nor would they, growing up, going to school, college, postgraduate work. Many are professionals, lawyers, engineers, accountants, sociologists, psychologists, plus upper-middle-class people, that one day they would actually wake up and not be able to be in their own home or apartment. They would have lost it. How'd that happen? Well, there's a larger picture, and we're going to explore that today. Commentary from Vi Ransel from Common Dreams, Manufacturing Poor People. That'll be our issue, and you'll have a chance to call in. Now, if for any reason you have not been able to get through on any of the other issues that we've raised, and you have something to share you feel is germane, you can also share that as well. Also, a common question, especially today with all of these tornadoes, the most in American history in any given state in any given period of time, why? Are these related to climate change? I will address the issue. Excuse me. The U.S. floods and fires, yeah, they are linked to climate change. More severe hurricanes, absolutely. Going from a category 1 to 2, 2 to 3 and up, yes. But the tornadoes, people have a hard time imagining that's dealing with climate change. I'll deal with that. Also, the latest on health and healing, I don't know the time will permit today, but I want to deal with our water wars that are beginning now. My guest will be Professor Nicholas Cardaris. And we're going to talk about the spiritual psychology of wellness and well-being among the ancient Greeks, such as Pythagoras and Plato, and how our culture of self-absorption damages our sense of health and well-being. I'm a great believer we can learn from both philosophy and history and the philosophy within history. So I'm going to take us back to an earlier time and show you that people were as concerned about their health and longevity, the body politic and social order, as we are today. We'd like to think that all reason and all thought must be contemporary to be valid. Not true. So, a lesson in history and philosophy today in the second part of our program with my guest, Professor Nicholas Cardaris. Excuse me, let us begin. Many people are eating a lot of seafood. They are the opinion that seafood's good. There's also some new and popular diets out there that emphasize seafood. I would suggest that you not have any seafood at all, for several reasons, not the least of which has a lot of science to back it up. In fact, if you were to read the current issue of Nature Geoscience, University of Alberta researchers have found that there's very high levels of mercury in seafood, and it's concentrating more and more and more. And it used to be, okay, you could have some wild fish. Well, in point of fact, the vast majority of fish are wild fish, but the fish are eating plankton, which is contaminated, and it has lots of mercury. But then the argument was, well, okay, but the mercury that goes into the water is harmless. It's inorganic mercury. And that's what is discharged by industry and coal burning. And that is correct if you only accepted a half-truth. Here's what the media that is supportive of industry doesn't tell you. Yes, the inorganic mercury is fairly harmless, not completely, when it's discharged into our water. However, then it becomes deadly monomethylmercury in the oceans, which progresses through the food chain from small creatures right up to humans who eat them. In fact, unborn babies and young infants are particularly sensitive to monomethylmercury's effects. Here's what we know it can do. It can cause brain and spinal cord damage. You can have twitching, jerking, breathing as a baby of the hands, feet, and arms and legs while awake and not attach it to the mercury in your brain, because it's very difficult to measure mercury in any part of the body, because the assumption is that mercury will be in the bloodstream. That's not true. We have found pregnant women who showed very little mercury, nothing of a high level in their blood, but then someone got the idea, why don't we just check the placental material? And there it was. So the mercury was concentrating in the placenta and hence going into the developing fetus. The research team led by a doctoral biologist incubated seawater samples collected from the Canadian Arctic archipelago, and that's where the report is. So stay away from sea food. It has high levels of mercury, and yes, half the issue is it's not as toxic going in the water, but then it becomes toxic. Now, something that we should all be consuming is broccoli. And there are a lot of ways of making it interesting. Just something as simple as lightly steaming it for 3 or 4 minutes. Why? Because if you were to eat raw broccoli or carrots, Brussels sprouts, or cauliflower, you're not going to get very much benefit from it. Because the fibrous part of that, what is called lignocellulose, is so tight that your body cannot really digest it fully. So the vast majority of nutrients, including phytonutrients and chlorophyll, which is locked inside the cell, doesn't allow for proper absorption. But when you lightly steam it, then that opens up the cell, making it very easy for the body to absorb its nutrients. And then sprouts, of course, are very good, and they should be eaten raw, but always wash sprouts. That's why I will never eat sprouts in a restaurant. Because more often than not, any sprouts you see on a dish as decorative part of the makeup of the dish presentation, they haven't been washed. You wash sprouts, they go soggy. So they just take it out of a bag and they put it up on there. Well, a lot of different hands could have handled it. It could have been grown in organic soil, which means that it could be carrying a lot of pathogens. But if you wash the sprouts thoroughly, and the best way to do it is wash it, and then just put it in a colander and run water over it, filtered water. Then they're fine. Here's why you should eat broccoli and sprouts. Some new research from Penn State College of Medicine revealed that a topical compound called ISC4 found in cruciferous vegetables, like Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, and broccoli, can increase sunscreen's ability to prevent melanoma lesions forming on the skin. So, despite the use of sunscreen and skin screenings, incidence of melanoma continue to increase. So this is one way you can actually protect your body. So every time you eat a cruciferous vegetable and you use a sunscreen, you increase the potential for protecting yourself against melanoma. And the ingredients are called isothiocyanates. Isothiocyanates, C-Y-A-N-T-E-S. These isothiocyanates are the inhibitors of what is called AKT3, and these are naturally occurring compounds found in cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and Brussels sprouts, and they have very strong anti-cancer properties. So the more that you use the cruciferous vegetables, the less cancer internally, but now melanoma externally. And this was published in Cancer Prevention Research. And also, I've said many times that when you have diabetes, you are at greater risk of heart disease, heart attack, and stroke, arthritis, depression, premature aging of the brain, and cancer. Here's the latest study. This was a National Institutes of Health ARP diet and health study. They showed, quote, our results provide further evidence that abnormal insulin and glucose signaling may contribute to cancer initiation and development, unquote. And that's from Dr. Lay of the U.S. National Cancer Institute. What it means in lay language is this. If you're diabetic, you increase your risk of dying of cancer by 8%. That's a lot of increased risk. So by controlling your blood sugar and controlling your weight, you're also reducing your risk of cancer. And finally, one spice that is universal and is really good for you, actually two last things, is cayenne pepper. I think cayenne is terrific. I've helped people lower their blood pressure, thin their blood, help them heal ulcers, all forms of things. It really is an all-round, full-spectrum healing nutrient. Hot cayenne pepper can also help burn calories and curb your appetite. That's according to a new study from Purdue University and published in Physiology and Behavior. So if you want to curb your appetite, just shake some cayenne into your health drink or put it on your salad or something you're consuming. They did a study, found out it works. So that's important. And finally, ginseng, another universally used herb, very important. I once contacted the FDA and asked them about the science behind ginseng. I never will forget. This person said, well, there is no science behind ginseng. I was sitting at my desk with a gigantic bound book of nothing but studies from the Chinese Academy of Sciences that had just 5,000 studies in Chinese, separate studies on the healing benefits of ginseng. I had a separate volume that was actually larger from South Korea and Japan. All told, over 14,000 studies, and yet our FDA didn't know that a single one existed. Hence the quackbusters and other supercilious people who know nothing about science or health go around saying, all these herbs can't, there's no science behind them. Yes, there is. There's tremendous science. Here's the latest. Extracts from ginseng roots can help prevent heart attacks, which is, as we know, is one of the leading causes of death in the world. And this was done at Chambuk National University. And a professor, Hoon, carried out the test and found that ginseng saponins, and the saponins are the healing power of ginsengs, were enormously important. Quote, extensive tests carried out in the past 18 months showed that ginseng, given in our experiments, and with increasing doses of saponin, exhibited 18% greater cardiac output compared to those who were not given the substance, unquote. So, this was published in the European Journal of Pharmacology, and it shows ginseng, I suggest 100 to 200 milligrams a day, so it can help prevent a heart attack. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Have lots of fancy clothes and drive a big fun Cadillac, not knowing all the time I had these things. My friends would stab me straight in my back. No, no, no. Even had a house out there in Beverly Hills. I was moving so fast, y'all. I didn't even have time to worry about paying my bills. My life.
Welcome you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall, and we're going to give you a brief commentary, and then that's our chance for you to call in on the issue segment of our program. And we have Joe in studio in New York City who's taken some of your questions off our website. I'm traveling throughout the world, completing two additional films that I have not discussed because of the sensitive nature of the material. Don't want anyone being talked out of being filmed, and that has happened many times. So we'll go to the issue, and then we'll go inside. Let me also mention that this Sunday is the final day for those of you who would like to train to do the New York City Marathon. Power walking it, jogging it, running it. We have all of our coaches that will be in the park this Sunday. We're beginning at 8 o'clock for those who've been there up to this point, and 9 o'clock for anyone coming new. And so if you haven't had a bit of training, no problem. We will have you start and get you into shape, and it'll be a wonderful experience. It's one of the most exhilarating experiences of your life when you do a 26-mile race that you never thought you could do. At your age, at your state of health, all the more reason to challenge yourself. And we've had hundreds of people show up. We have one of the largest groups that we're training right now ever. It's free. There's no charges. And you're going to learn a lot about life. So if you've been there for the last 3 weeks, come at 8 o'clock, 90th Street and 5th Avenue, right inside Central Park. If you're coming for the first time, come at 9 o'clock. 8 o'clock for everyone else, 9 o'clock. We'll have coaches there, and we'll get you into shape. But this is your last opportunity to start, because from here on out, we're into full training. Did you ever ask yourself, how did so many people get so poor in a relatively short period of time? And not just poor, but so poor they can't even afford food. Where historically many people have been poor, but they have been able to be fairly healthy. They've been able to grow food and barter and exchange. Well, even as the overall population of the world continues to increase, and the increase in the number of poor people outstrips that growth, how is this possible? Are the poor simply breeding like rabbits, increasing their numbers geometrically in a suicidal, lemming-like production line of poverty-stricken people? That's what we've been told. Hence one of the reasons that we're told that a vaccine, yeah, Bill Gates, a vaccine that could help population control. Gee, Bill, you going to suggest all the Caucasian, wealthy, upper-middle-class people, America's aristocracy, are you going to start with them? Are they going to be the first to have no more children? No. No. In just the last 50 years, the rich people of the first or Western world have invested heavily through their banks, industries, and other corporations in the poorest regions of the third world in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, home to the majority of the world's poor. Transnational corporations are attracted by the richness of these people's natural resources, the richness of profits off cheap labor. So put this up, cheap labor, the number one reason. But there are more. The near total lack of environmental and worker safety regulations. No hassle. Exploit people in any way you want. Oh, that's number two. And how about the non-existent benefits for that labor? Oh, that's number three. The U.S. transnationals were given a push towards this pregnant profit source, this attractive and waiting richness by the U.S. government, which subsidizes, meaning you and I pay for it. They subsidize these corporations in the form of tax breaks on foreign investment and even helping them to pay their relocation expenses at the expense of not only the taxpayers in the United States, but those taxpayers whose jobs are outsourced by this support for global U.S. economic dominance. So you understand what I'm saying. Part of your taxes go to the corporation that just fired you. So you are paying for that corporation to be able to make even more profit in relocating in another country. Local businesses in the third world are destroyed by U.S. transnationals as they penetrate and overwhelm their markets like species imported to get rid of pests, which turn out to be even bigger pests themselves. Taxpayer-subsidized cartels of transnationals dump their cheap surplus goods in these countries at below their own cost to undersell local producers. Who was the superstar, the Michael Jordan, of bringing in cheap food into the Caribbean and South America? Bill Clinton. Put that up there as one of his merit badges. Oh, did I forget? We never ask him a hard question ever in the media. Heaven help the media if, and especially the liberal media, if they ever actually had the courage to hold him responsible for the myriad things he did, including virtually single-handedly destroying the entire farming community in Jamaica. But he didn't. And he was praised for it. Anything that helps the transnationals make more profit, well, that's just kind of good for that big ego. So now you're bringing in American-made products into these countries, and you're underselling all the local people, thus forcing them out of business and allowing the U.S. corporations to take over the market and then, of course, increase the prices. This is also Walmart's favorite technique for killing the competition in local markets right here in the United States. In the case of big agriculture, they also take over and expropriate the best pieces of land, monocrop that land with products for export, and douse them with oil-based chemical fertilizers and toxic pesticides destroying the soil. Think Dust Bowl, 1930s. That's what we bring to tropical regions of the world. This leaves less land for use for those run-out-of-business farmers and those and their families to produce the food to feed the local population, who, along with the displaced farmers, are forced to go to work for next to nothing on those monocrop plantations to grow food that will be shipped out of the country or to work in American subcontracted sweatshop factories. This also forces them to buy what food they can afford from these same big agri corporations. This is exactly the same scenario as in the United States. Think the bulk of U.S. population consists of dependent consumers, unable to feed themselves. Wait, stupid me. I forgot. Every American, from those living on terrace gardens overlooking Fifth Avenue to all of you in the suburbs, you're all self-sufficient. You've gotten ahead of that curve. You've actually awakened, and you're even able... No. No, 99.9% of Americans couldn't grow a tomato, let alone a blade of grass, to subsist on. So what they do is they go and buy everything, thinking, well, I'll always have the money to buy what I need. Why should I be conscious enough to actually grow it, store it, save for that rainy day? Robbing local people of self-sufficiency creates a perfect profit-making mechanism based on a labor market flooded with desperate people who can be herded in a neat, ready-to-use package, labor in a box, in slums and shanty towns, which they will leave to slave for token poverty wages, if they can find work, which are most often in violation of their own country's minimum wage laws. This is thanks to the overreaching authority of the Western-created free trade agreements enforced by the World Trade Organization, in my personal opinion, one of the single most corrupt, vile, evil organizations in the history of the planet. And it is unaccountable to any court in the world. It is the court. And thank Bill Clinton and his cronies and suck-ups. Oh, I forgot. I'm equating Democrat-liberal Clintonites with progressive liberals. No, they are not the same. Shame on those who haven't figured out what progressive means. And since the U.S. is one of the few pariah nations, yes, we are a pariah nation, travel with me one day, not Bill O'Reilly, the other people who can never see us doing anything that could cause blowback, or somehow the world is just envious of us because they don't have what we have. You know, well, thank God a lot of people don't have what we have, especially our arrogance. And then we refuse to sign the international conventions for the abolishment of child labor and forced labor. That's correct. Walmart, Disney, JCPenney, we're able to pay 11 cents. You heard me right. Let me be very specific. 11 cents an hour in Haiti in 2007. Walmart, Disney, and JCPenney, 11 cents an hour. So if you own stock in those companies, I don't blame them. I blame you. You own stock, it's your responsibility to find out where that corporation and how it makes its money. If it's making it off slave labor, then you're a promoter of slavery. Ah, well, that ought to make you think for a moment. Not. As long as we get our checks, somehow we suspend all rational, reasonable thought. This allows these transnational corporations, not only in the third world, but here in the United States, which we're becoming a third world, to have workers as young as 12, you heard me right, 12 years of age sustain high rates of death and injuries while working for less than the minimum wage. Talk about your right to work. Why didn't I see the teachers protesting this? 11 cents an hour. The savings these transnationals and their shareholders are able to rack up by exploiting and further impoverishing the people of the third world do not translate into lower prices for the consumers. People of the first or Western world, oh no. Transnationals don't outsource to save their customers money. They do it to increase their profits and their payouts to shareholders. For instance, children in Indonesia in 1990 made shoes for 13 cents an hour working 12-hour days. The shoes cost $2.60 to make per pair. They sold in the United States for $100 to $120 a pair. In addition to this slick trick, any U.S. aid to these transnationals in impoverished countries comes with stainless steel strings attached. Beside the aid's money being used to create an infrastructure like ports and railroads and airports and highways and refineries and utilities, all of which are meant for facilitating the transnational ability to make money at the expense of local economies, this so-called fraudulent aid must often be spent on U.S. goods, thus enriching even more U.S. corporations. The country receiving this so-called aids must also give investment preference to even more U.S. corporations. This causes a shift away from product produced locally and towards those imported from the West, creating even more debt, dependency, and hunger. Further, a lot of this aid slips silently into the silken pockets of the local ruling class to buy their complicity and even enlist them in the enforcement of the ongoing heist. Hand in hand with U.S. aid comes more help from the World Bank, an utterly corrupt organization, and the International Monetary Fund. The financial contributions to those organizations by countries belonging to them determines the weight of their voting power. And since the U.S. is the largest donor, you can just guess the name of that tune. And of course, the International Monetary Fund works under a cloak of secrecy and enforced by the banks and the treasury organizations of the rich nations who run it. The World Bank loans money to a poor country to help it in its development to build up its economy if and almost certainly when the poor country is able or unable to pay the usurious interest on the loan because of declining exports. The country has to borrow more money in order to service the debt. The International Monetary Fund extends more loans with more of those stainless steel strings more tightly bound around the victim, and I mean loan recipients there, trusting up the benefiting poor nation like a Thanksgiving turkey about to be devoured by the West, the rich. The country which borrows money from these groups must give tax breaks to wealthy transnationals. The country must slash wages, refuse to protect local businesses, refuse unionization, refuse minimal wages, refuse environmental cleanup for being ravaged by cheap imports and corporate takeovers. The country is further strong-armed to sell at fire prices all of its government-owned mines, its railroads, its industries, utilities to privately owned, mostly foreign corporations. The country must allow its forests to be clear-cut and its land strip-mined. Money for education, health care, food assistance, and transportation infrastructure must be shredded to service the debt and the interest on the debt through the wondrously magical Western miracle of compound interest. Keeps growing and growing and growing and growing and on and on and on. And all the while, the people of the country are less able to feed themselves since they are forced to grow cash crops for export to feed that debt service. This is how the third world is kept in poverty, subjugated by the first world whose people purposely, premeditatedly impoverish and immiserate the people of the third world via depraved indifference in order to serve the plump, plutocratic pleasures of the Democrat, liberal, conservative, Republican, transnational corporations, their shareholders, and the American consumer. This debt reaches a point where nearly all of a country's export earnings go to debt payment, squeezing the economy like a lemon in the poverty-making snowballs. And while critics of this aid program most often faux progressives, phony progressives, of which there are many, just listen to NPR if you want to hear them, point out that these programs just don't work for those people, the people of the third world nations. These same programs continue to receive funding from their adherents precisely because they do work exactly as they were intended to work, to transfer the rich resources of the poor in the third world to the already wealthy people in the first world. What an arrogant, ludicrous appellation is first world self-designated by rich people to describe and denigrate the poor people of whom the scaffold supporting the American Western standard of living is built. This is how the magical trickle-down economics of the Friedmans, the Reagans, the Volkers, the Greenspan, the Bushes, the Rockefeller, the Clintons, the Obamas, the Rothschilds, who proselytize free market theology works. The people of the third world are used as fertilizer to grow the fortunes of the people of the first or the Western world. They are used like toilet paper, like disposable plastic packaging, like prophylactics, and then discarded as if their lives meant nothing more. They are receptacles, vessels in which the rich create their self-made wealth, do their business, then casually flush these poor people and their children out of sight down the polluted toilet of the first world. Transnational corporations use the U.S. government and the corporate lobbyists' written free trade policies, which are designed and work very well to prevent third world nations from ever developing sufficiently to become serious trade competitors. And this is because U.S. corporations learned the lesson of the Marshall Plan very well. After World War II, America's major trade competitors were flattened economically as well as physically in America, and all of its benevolence and magnanimity offered money to Europe and Japan so they could rebuild shattered industries and infrastructure by using this aid money to purchase American goods and services, profiting hugely in this process. And while Europe and Japan were rebuilding, the U.S. was busy establishing itself as the world's global economic and military power. Following World War II and up to the mid-70s, the U.S. experienced the most prosperous period overall in its history, and then things began to go south as former flattened economic competitors began to recover enough to give the power of the United States a run for its money and actually overtaking it, the once supremely economically dominant USA. Well, U.S. transnationals didn't intend to ever let that happen again. There would be no more giving a real leg up to potential competitors, and thus we arrived at where we're at today. And in fact, the ruse worked so well that since the 70s, the plutocracy has been using the very same template here at home with an increasingly heavy hand. See the U.S. auto workers, health care, the bank bailout, foreclosure of homes, 600,000 jobs, a month jettison, the murder of state governments, etc., etc., and the lack of competition within our educational system. Your thoughts, please. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Why don't everybody put your hands together? Clap along with the music. The song is not a very hard one, you see, but I'd like everybody to listen to what I'm saying to you. You're the reason I want to live, girl. I swear you're the reason I want to give.
I'm Gary Nolan. You're listening to the number one progressive radio program in the United States. This is where the truly independent and progressive conservative and progressive liberals, the constitutionalists, the libertarians with the humanistic side of them showing, and the Greens come to share thoughts. I've got Joe in studio. We've got people lining up to give their thoughts. Let's say hello to Joe in the studio. Hi, Joe.
How's it going, Gary?
Doing great.
Pretty good. I got some emails for you if you got the time.
Go ahead.
We got Sheila from Kansas City. She writes, Gary, I'm told now is the right time to buy a house. There's great savings and great deals. What do you think?
Absolutely, you shouldn't be buying anything at this time. You should be selling. Why? Because go back 3 years ago, before the bubble burst, I said that we would be having a bubble collapse, five bubbles. I said that we would have between a 20 to 40% decrease in the value over the next 2 years. Well, nationally, if you just took the national average, we're down 32%. But if you live in Arizona, it's 56% of housing value lost. In Nevada, it's 58%. In fact, in Las Vegas, 70% of all home mortgages are underwater. They're dead. They're gone. Not coming back. 70% of all the homes in Las Vegas. And due to the housing crisis, there's now 167,000 vacant homes in the state of Nevada. So you say, well, what a great deal. Why don't I buy one of those 167,000 homes? A great bargain. Great bargain compared to what the high end of the market was. 2 years from now, you're going to have 300,000 empty homes in Nevada, and you're going to be have anywhere from 20 to 40% less value, because you got to look, not only is the real estate market going to continue to tumble, I believe from 20 to 50% in the next 2 years, but the value of the dollar is going to collapse, absolutely collapse. Do you think Japan's going to buy any more of our debt? China's going to buy our debt? No, they're not. They want to get, Japan cannot, and China is now looking at being the number one producer of gold in the world, which it is, in metric tons, about 124 metric tons of gold, but also you're going to have mixed currencies. That means the dollar is going to go down in value because the Fed keeps printing money with nothing to back it up to buy the treasury notes. Give those to banks at zero interest, and they're charging the U.S. taxpayer and the Treasury anywhere from 25 to 350% interest, which is 3.5%. They get it for zero. So if you get it, if you get money for zero, and you loan it back to the person that gave it to you at 3.5%, you've just made 350% profit. It's insane. Based upon what Bank of America did last year, they made about $400 million net profit just on the interest for money that cost them nothing. This is a kind of fraud. So where do you think that our value is going to go when we no longer have a zero interest rate? When interest starts to go to 4, 5, 6, 7%, you're going to see hyperinflation. So the value of the houses are going to go down. The amount of houses are going to under distress. For example, down in Miami-Dade County, 24% of all houses, every single house, is underwater, going to foreclosure or short sale. According to a recent survey, 13% of every single home in the United States. Listen to what I just said, Joe. 13% of every home in the United States is empty. Did you hear what I just said?
I did.
Never before in American history, not even the Great Depression, have we seen this many empty homes, this many foreclosures. In fact, in Detroit alone, 33 homes are abandoned. In the average home in the city of Merced, California, they've declined by 63% in value. We've lost $6.3 trillion in the housing market. We have 546,000 total foreclosures. During the year, that's over 4% of all housing units in the state of California. And one other one, I'll take one more quick one from
you. Gotcha. We've had several emails, actually, Gary, from listeners yesterday asking if you could be a little more specific about the solar superstorm that NASA is predicting.
It's not, is this going to happen, it's when. NASA is predicting next year. Imagine Katrina. You're familiar with Katrina. The hurricane hit New Orleans. Imagine it 100,000 times worse. You heard me right. It's not an exaggeration. 100,000 times. This is based upon the Earth's magnetic field. There are massive, massive leaks in the Earth's magnetic field. So solar storms can wreak havoc. In fact, it will literally end life as we know it today. And it will shift the magnetic global phenomena. And this is NASA saying that. And just imagine everything that works off electricity. All the power grids, our entire nation's power grid, could be overheat, and all air travel would be disrupted because you don't have any electronics. Navigational systems, satellite systems, they would all stop working. That's when the sun reaches its maximum power. And the sun the sun, when the sun comes out of this long slumber, you're going to see some violent mammoth magnetic storms. Now, so an elevator wouldn't work. Television, computers, cell phones. No one could fly an airplane unless it was in the daytime and you could see around you. But with as many flights as people have, that'd be suicidal to go up an airplane. Think of all your electronic appliances. Nothing on electric grid would work. You would have to. The irony of it is, those who don't live on that grid would be the best off. Where would you get your food? How long would you last before you starve to death? Your refrigerator, what's going to keep it cold? If you live in a hot climate, what's going to cool you down? How are you going to get your water sprinklers to work? If you live in a cold climate, if you have oil, yeah, that'll work. Gas, natural gas, that'll work. Wood, that would work. If you're advanced enough to have solar directly and solar generators, that's good. Wind, that would be good. Rushing water would be the best. But you'd have to have some combination in order to survive. But people living in the cities, forget about it. Within 2 weeks of a major solar system storm, a superstorm hitting a city, there would be no food left. There'd be major riots. Within 3 weeks, people would be dead of dehydration, starvation. Because without electricity, how are you going to get your water pumps to pump the water up into the buildings? Gravitational pull brings it to the city. It will not get it up in to where you need it. So just imagine what it's going to be like. Now imagine that no one's talking about it. No politicians, no one in the media, because we have no solutions that they're going to put into place. Not that we don't have some solutions. We certainly do. We have some technologies that could be implemented. But it's not an issue. How in the world can a super solar storm compete with the news on Donald Trump and birthers? And it can't. And the wedding of these two clowns in England. You can't compete with that. So the end of the world as we know it, not the end of all life, but the end of our lifestyle as we know it, there's no room for our consciousness to be able to deal with that. Okay, thank you.
No problem, Gary.
One quick call. We go to our guest after that. Let's say hello to Verna.
Hi, Gary.
Yes, hi.
Hi, how are you? This is Verna Gray. I'm calling to thank you for the wonderful, wonderful program that you started at my school, the Gray Charter School in Newark, New Jersey. It was a healthy eating and lifestyle and exercise program. And the parents are really responding to it. And they're very receptive to changing their way of life and eating, and the children are also receptive to it as well. And, you know, I have several parents that have lost quite a bit of weight, and their blood pressure has been lowered, and their cholesterol is lowered, and they're still working at the program. And thanks to you, when you came back in November and first gave a lecture, I have students that are still telling me about what you said way back in November, and the parents as well. But I'm just very happy about how the progress that they've made. You know, I have parents that have lost over 32 pounds in 4 months because of the program. And one woman told me she had never done that in her life. But because of the program you started, she's really, you know, working at it and eating better. And the tapes, you brought a lot of tapes and books, and they're reading the books. And we have meetings every other week to encourage them to continue and to talk about, you know, what you brought to us already, to continue to motivate the parents and the children. And they're doing really great. And I'm just so happy about this program. And we're going to continue it because we've seen children losing weight. We've seen parents losing weight, and we want to continue it so they, you know, it'll be like total school wide, where more and more parents are joining in now.
Good for you. I'll be back in New York. I'm traveling. I got to go out, and I'm filming this 12 tipping points from all over the world. But when I come back, I'll come back out there, and we'll have a discussion about this, because I want every school in America that has the power for people in the school to help the children and get past all these boards and administrators and the inertia and the politic to actually care about the students who seem to be left
right
out of all this discussion.
Yes. Right, that's very
true. And I was happy to see how well your students are doing. They're some of the best-tested students in the United States.
Right.
And what's possible. And so,
Gary,
thank you.
I want to tell, can I tell you about one little boy who was diagnosed with ADHD? He is so much better. I can't even believe it. He now sits quietly in his seat because his mother has put him on the diet, the total diet change. We don't call it a diet. We call it a lifestyle change. He's now eating organic fruits and vegetables. He eats a lot more fruits and vegetables. She's put him on the exercise program. She only came to two of the lectures, but she was determined that her son and her were going to be on the program. And he sits just like everyone else in the class, and people can't believe the change in him. He's very quiet and orderly. He sits in morning assembly. My school opens 7:30, and I teach morning assembly, and when I ask questions, the children are supposed to raise their hand and wait until I call on them to answer. And he does that now. He used to couldn't do that, but he does that very well now. And, you know, people are saying, well, how could he do such a tremendous change? And I attribute it to the change that his mother changed and started eating the type of foods that you had listed in your book, the Power Foods book. She's put him on that, on the different recipes. And she came to the lectures, and she made sure he wasn't eating a lot of the different foods that you had stated not to eat. And I'm just very happy with this whole program.
Well, good. Well, we're going to continue. And, again, any school in the United States that's willing to work, it's all free. The books, the videos, the lectures, the food, thousands of pounds of grains I give. I'm willing to do all this to help a child.
Right. I really appreciate it.
And I just wish it were easy enough that people, parents, teachers said, yes, let's just help the children. But somehow in America, in our educational system, no, the child is the last issue. It's all the other political issues and self-interest issues that stand between us. So you, at your charter school, allowed the children to come first, and we will continue on that path, and hopefully other schools, both public and public as regular schools and public as charter schools, will be able to benefit their children. Thank you very much, Verna.
You're welcome.
My guest, I mentioned him earlier, Professor Nicholas Carderis, is a certified psychotherapist specializing in addiction and transpersonal studies and consciousness. He's a clinical professor at Stony Brook University and also an adjunct professor of conscious studies at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. And he's the author of How Plato and Pythagoras Can Save Your Life, the Ancient Greek Prescription for Health and Happiness. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be here, Gary. I'm a big fan. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like for you to begin, and I'm really turning this over to you to have this discussion with us, of observing today how the ancient Greek philosophers and mystics and healers and were able to look at their universe, the contemplation of the world around them and all of its splendor, and also how they use that to promote mental, emotional, and physical and spiritual well-being, and then take a look at that and juxtaposition it with so many people today who live a very mechanistic existence, who are out of touch with their own internal healing, who never talk about philosophy. Philosophical questions are rare today. We're a culture of self-absorption, and our society is so self-centered, and it's very damaging in our sense of well-being and contributes so much stress. So take us on this historical journey of philosophy and how we can benefit from it today.
Right, that was beautifully said, by the way, Gary. Yeah, we've evolved into a culture that's self-absorbed rather than self-reflective. And, you know, in 6th century BC, there was a revolution, a consciousness revolution that happened in ancient Greece. And as Plato had said, all philosophy begins in wonder. And what that really means is that the wonder of the universe, looking up at the night sky and sort of trying to reflect and sort of better understand what the nature of the universe is, which is called cosmology, and what the nature of our own existence is. And the Greeks understood fairly profoundly that there's an elevating effect that happens when somebody does that. When somebody really tries to look up at the sky and wonder, you know, the deep existential questions, what it's all about, there's a transformative effect that happens in contemplative studies and in meditative studies. There's this idea that when we meditate or contemplate something, we become the object of our contemplation. So if I'm meditating or contemplating the nature of infinity, in the sense I become infinite, and the Greeks call this theosis, if I'm meditating the concept of God or the allness of the universe, I then entrain and become part of that allness of the universe. I become part of that larger collective. So there's a real benefit to that. the problem that's happened with the perception of Greek philosophy through the centuries has been, what I like to say, it's been hijacked by philosophy professors. And people's conception of philosophy or Greek philosophy has been one where it's very cerebral and academic and sort of a dry intellectual pursuit. And the reality, Gary, couldn't be further from the truth. Pythagoras and Plato were really, the metaphysicians were really, in a sense, mystics. They were, and yogis, they were into, right, mind-body healing. And very profoundly, the Pythagoreans used to do intense physical exercise every day. They were vegetarians. They did contemplative exercises, not only on cosmology, but on mathematics and music. Pythagoras was into string theory before Brian Greene and all the other physicists. Pythagoras perceived the universe to be harmonic and vibrational. And he believed that the human body was like a lyre, it was our greatest instrument, and that we need to have that properly tuned to be in alignment with a larger harmony of the universe. So by eating right, by acting right, by thinking right, we were actually able to align ourselves into a sort of a harmony and an alignment. And these ideas are very holistic. They're very in alignment with some of the Eastern beliefs, which I've also teach and study a lot. And somewhere along the line through the centuries, that holistic wisdom of ancient Greek philosophy as a way of life, as a way of being, as a way of experiencing the world, it really became lost. And I think it's been to our detriment that we lost that, because what's happened is we've become what some psychologists called an empty self society. Our self-concept, how we think of ourselves, is empty. And so rather than informing ourselves or by looking up at the night sky and wondering what it's all about, we're distracted. We're looking to fill our emptiness with what Carl Jung and what I call the shiny baubles of American Idol, or, you know, and I'm not putting down popular culture. It has a place, but we've become consumed by the emptiness of the outside validating things, whether it's pop culture, whether it's you know, social media. And I think that's, for a very large degree, why we're an anxious culture, an addicted culture, a consuming culture, because we're trying to fill our emptiness in very superficial ways. And Plato and Pythagoras understood that we need to give our lives meaning and texture and purpose through these kinds of ways of being and experiencing the world, not through just consumption or distraction. And so that in shorthand is sort of the essence of what I really try to privilege in my book. I try to uncover this ancient wisdom and make it really practical and experiential in people's lives. You know, how can you on a day-to-day basis really embrace some of these ancient ideas of being aligned with a larger harmony of the universe? How can you have meaning in your life? I'm sorry, Gary, go ahead.
No, Nicholas, that's one of the things I'd like for you to discuss. I'm going to ask our land-based stations to continue on for an additional 5 minutes. If for any reason they can't, people can continue listening to this conversation on progressiveradionetwork.com. Here's a big issue today. Mm-hmm. We have become so hyper-stimulated by distractions that the high that a person feels when they're on some form of narcotic or some form of, let's say, like caffeine or sugar, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or cocaine, then when they have that withdrawn, they say they feel flat and empty, and they want that high again, and hence they've lost the appreciation of all subtle and healing energies. And they need a constant, hyper, full-speed adrenaline fix. Talk about mm-hmm. what it was like back in the ancient times. How did they come to not feel that their life was empty, and how did they deal with those flat times, and how could we?
Yeah, well, obviously there wasn't the level of hyperstimulation that we have today. And just briefly, on to sort of piggyback on what you're saying about how we've become desensitized to the subtleties of everything in life, Joseph Chilton Pierce cites a German study that's a longitudinal multi-decade study that tracks the effect of high-impact stimulation, you know, virtual and television kind of stimulation on our senses, and how in the 1960s, people, human beings, and the people in the study in Germany that were studied were able to perceive 300 shades of red. A decade later, they were able to perceive 150 shades of red. A decade later, in the 1980s, it was in 70 or 80 shades of red. Today, we're able to perceive 30 or 40 shades of red. That's a really gross physical manifestation of what you're talking about. Even our senses have been dulled by this hyperstimulation, much less our spiritual way of being and our emotional way of being. We're so desensitized. Yeah, the ancient Greeks, like all mystics, tried to directly experience the fullness of the universe, and they understood, they were amongst the first to understand that our senses, the sensorial world, can be can sort of get in the way of our experience of, you know, quote-unquote reality. And that's what Plato's myth of the cave allegory was all about, that what we perceive with our five senses might not be all there is. And the analogy that I give is the tip of the iceberg. Our senses expose us to 10% of the real world or a percentage of the real world, but there's much more that lay underneath the surface. And what keeps us from experiencing that allness of being is our habituated ways of thinking, our senses, and the hyperstimulation that you're talking about. So meditation and contemplative practices were a very profound part of that. The Pythagoreans started every morning by taking quiet, reflective walks in nature to, what Pythagoras said, to quiet their restless minds. And so you would start each day sort of centering yourself. And then there was a sense that when you did a contemplative meditation and you meditated on something like the nature of the universe, you sort of tried to experience things beyond your intellectual mind, you know, and I use the term, and a lot of others have used the term, transrational ways of experiencing the world beyond the rational, which is very mystical, which is very non-intellectual. It's very left-brain rather than right-brain way of experiencing the world. And so once you start doing that, you start sort of opening the veil, peeling back the layers of reality. And then all of a sudden, your sense of purpose starts becoming clearer and clearer as to who are we as human beings. A big part of this alignment with our larger harmony and purpose is acting correctly. The Greeks were all about character and acting correctly, because I could meditate all I want, and I could have wonderful meditative insights, but if I'm not living, quote-unquote, a character-correct life, if I'm not doing the right thing, then it's all for naught. So part of that alignment was aligning my actions in accordance with this higher sense of purpose. So that was a big part of it also. And in my book, I go step by step of different meditative exercises to do to help a person sort of center themselves and experience that allness of the universe that we're talking about.
If people only could appreciate for a moment taking a little time travel to see how did Spinoza and Eurydicles and Sophocles and Maimonides, how did these individuals come to grips with their own mortality, their own sense of placement in their society and the universe? We like to think that somehow all this started with us, and it didn't. And people have always had problems with their children. Cicero made an interesting comment about the difficulty of children. Well, sure.
Right.
And
right.
So our problems are only unique in the context of how we're experiencing them, not that they're unique problems.
Absolutely.
So I'm glad that you wrote this important work, How Plato and Pythagoras Can Save Your Life. I think it's a very important contribution to our overall understanding. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
Professor Nicholas Cardaras, Cardaras. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen to us today. I look forward to sharing more, including the Sunday night program at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. And that's all about calling in and sharing your points of view. I realize our shows are so packed, not a lot of people could get in each day to share their issue part, but you certainly will have that time on Sunday evening, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network. Now, in a moment, one of the most popular programs on Progressive Radio Network and one of the most progressive programs in the United States, Danny Schechter, the News Dissector.
The show is produced at our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.